Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.
This is Quality of Life, Valley Public Radio's look at the people and the issues affecting the way we live in the San Joaquin Valley. Here is your host, Joe Moore.
Well, hello and welcome. California is known worldwide as a state especially prone to earthquakes. The 1994 Northridge quake and the 1989 Loma Prieta quake are still fresh in the minds of many Californians. But deep in California's Central Valley, far from the San Andreas and the state's major population centers, what are the risks to residents and to our infrastructure? We'll ask those questions and more on our program today. Later in the hour, we'll talk about the threat an earthquake could pose to the Lake Isabella Dam in Kern County and what's being done to reduce the risk of a dam failure and how agencies would respond in the event of a major emergency. We'll also take a look back at past earthquakes here in Central California, such as the twin 1952 earthquakes that struck Kern County and devastated much of downtown Bakersfield, and the 1983 Coalinga earthquake that leveled much of that small Fresno County town. If you're a survivor of either of those past earthquakes, we'd love to hear from you on our program today. You can call us at 559-275-8989 or toll-free 1-800-224-8989 and share your story with our audience. Right now, though, we're joined by Dr. Stephen Lewis, Associate Professor of Geophysics and Chair of the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Fresno State. Dr. Lewis, welcome to our program today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
The issue of earthquakes is in the news recently with the events in Japan, but this is an issue that's always top of mind for California residents, maybe not as much so for residents here in the interior of California. Is there a perception, perhaps misplaced, that this part of California is less susceptible to earthquakes and earthquake damage than perhaps other parts of the state?
I think that perception is actually justified by the history of earthquakes in California and also the location of the active faults that produce the earthquakes. It turns out that the intensity of ground shaking that might be experienced at any particular spot is a function of how big an earthquake may be, how close the earthquake epicenter is to your house or your city, and the local ground conditions. And in the Central Valley, for the most part, we're pretty far from the active faults. So the hazard that we live under in terms of earthquake hazard is pretty minimal compared to most of California.
When it comes to talking about earthquakes in California, much of the discussion for years is centered on the San Andreas Fault. There have been a number of, I don't want to say predictions, but a number of scientists who have felt that the San Andreas is overdue. Can you tell our listeners a little more about what that means and how that relates to the overall system that we have here in California, plate tectonics? It's a very complicated and fascinating a field of study.
Certainly. It's true that the San Andreas Fault is the big player in terms of earthquakes in California and seismic risk. The closer you are to the San Andreas Fault, the more likely you may experience intense ground shaking at some time in the future. However, the driving force for earthquakes in California is the long, slow, inexorable motion of the Pacific Plate underneath the Pacific Ocean and a little bit of the land of California, and the North American Plate to the east of the San Andreas Fault. And that motion just continues all the time and is occasionally manifested by slip on a fault, which produces an earthquake. The bad news is that that just continues to happen at continual rates, roughly about 2.5 or so centimeters per year. The good news is that when the San Andreas or other faults slip, the whole fault doesn't slip at the same time, at least not historically. Different sections of the fault slip and produce a large or very large or medium-sized earthquake. And the hypothesis that seismologists follow is that the areas that have not experienced an earthquake for a long time along the San Andreas are more likely to slip in the near future than areas that have ruptured more recently.
For years, scientists have been looking at the community of Parkfield in just outside of our listening area in the hills of the Central Coast. Tell us about what that means and what happened or perhaps didn't happen there and what that means for this field of study.
One of the things that geologists and seismologists have always wanted to do is identify things that might be precursory to an earthquake, things that if you observe, you can anticipate an earthquake happening in that area in the near future. And Parkfield has a long history of a medium-sized earthquake happening every 34 years or so, with a certain amount of variability, of course. And the U.S. Geological Survey decided that instrumenting the Parkfield area of the San Andreas Fault might be a really good place to try to capture these precursory events. And so they spent a lot of money and a lot of time putting all of these instruments around the Parkfield area, drilling wells and putting downhole seismometers around the fault and all kinds of things to try to capture precursors. Good idea. So far, we haven't learned anything hugely important about the process yet.
Now, looking at some of the earthquakes the state has experienced over the years, and both in recent memory and going back to much earlier days, a lot of them, in fact, many of the ones that have had significant destruction, significant damage, significant loss of life, didn't occur on the San Andreas. We're looking at events such as the Kalinga earthquake in 1983, the Twin Kern County earthquakes back in 1952, the Long Beach earthquake, which killed 120 back in 1933. Is there a danger, perhaps, in putting so much public attention on the San Andreas that we're forgetting about some of these other risks that we have and some of these other faults that could cause significant damage in and of themselves?
Focusing on the San Andreas as the exclusive problem for earthquakes in California is a big mistake, I think. Like you said, the 1933 Long Beach earthquake, the Kern County earthquakes, which took place on the Garlock Fault, the Coalinga earthquake, actually the Loma Prieta earthquake happened on a subsidiary strand and not on the San Andreas proper, and the San Gregorio-Hosgri Fault that are just offshore along the coast. There are a lot of active faults in California, and if you're close enough to one of them, when they rupture in an earthquake, the damage can be significant.
If you just joined us on Quality of Life today here on Valley Public Radio, we're talking about earthquakes and what it means for the Valley. And we'd especially like to hear from you if you're someone who's lived through one of these events here in Central California. And specifically, we'd like to hear from survivors of the 1983 Kalinga earthquake and the twin earthquakes in the summer of 1952, which devastated much of Bakersfield. And we're talking with Dr. Stephen Lewis of Fresno State on our program today. We'd also like to bring in on the telephone now Kate Long. She is the deputy manager of the Quake and Tsunami Program of CalEMA, the California Emergency Management Agency. Kate, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
How much has California learned over the years in preparing for these sorts of disasters? It's been a few years since we've had a major, major quake, although San Diego and Southern California experienced a quake not that long ago. And then in the Central Coast, the San Simeon Paso Robles area had a significant earthquake a few years ago. How much have we learned and improved our response to these types of events over the years?
Well, you know, earthquake preparedness, both at the government level and at the public level, is something that's really an ongoing process. And certainly every time we have an earthquake, we have a chance as emergency managers to carry out our response activities, and every time we do that, we learn something. And also, it's really a window after there's an event. It's a window when the public is really thinking, gee, this could happen to me, and that's when we focus on public preparedness, because there's so much right after a large event that government won't be able to do, and that's why we really stress that self-reliance is really a way you can feel like you have some control and some ability to make a difference in what your family is like after an earthquake or really like after any disaster or emergency event.
is it much more challenging to motivate the public to prepare for something like an earthquake, which we have no advance warning for, versus something like if we were in the South or the Gulf Coast area, a hurricane where there's obviously some advance notice that something is coming on the way? It seems that Californians have this interesting outlook on life and earthquakes. We live with this threat all the time, yet it's there, and we don't necessarily, so many of us don't, perhaps aren't as prepared as we maybe should be.
Well, you know, it's funny. Because it happens so irregularly, we're almost hardwired, sociologists tell us, to think that it can't happen, or if it does happen, it won't happen to us. But that's not true statistically. And people kind of get intimidated by preparing. But really, people are already, they have a lot of preparations that they may have made, not because an earthquake is coming, but just in their own, you know, lives, like having water on hand. Well, if your water heater is strapped to survive earthquake shaking, you have probably 40 gallons of water right there. So having supplies, having a plan with your family, a reunification plan, an out-of-state or out-of-area number so you can contact each other should communication lines be down. There's a lot of things that people can do incrementally which will make them feel safer and more in control, like they're protecting their families and, you know, really able to survive whatever happens.
You mentioned the great strain that local agencies, local government will be under in the event of a major emergency such as an earthquake. Obviously, a lot of the major population centers of the state have very robust programs and efforts to deal with such crises. Here in the Valley, we have a lot of small communities. One of them, Kalinga, was struck in 1983 by quite a devastating quake. What about the small communities? Are they as prepared proportionally? Are they on board as much as they should be with preparedness efforts statewide?
Well, you know, we all suffer challenges in terms of funding and personnel and ability to do all the things we want to do in government, particularly in preparedness because we're working on, you know, the day-to-day things that come up. But I think that not only are small communities aware of what they need to do and they are doing planning, but the state of California and Cal EMA specifically and our regions work very closely with local governments, and when large events happen in small communities, the state government is really aware that we need to be standing by with mutual aid to assist local communities as they request it.
This is a little outside of our topic specifically today in dealing with earthquakes, and our coverage area doesn't quite extend to the Central Coast, but talk, if you can, a little bit about the response to the tsunami and the damage here in the state recently with the Japanese earthquake.
You know, the tsunami is important even to people inland, and we learned that in the March 11th tsunami event in California, and we learned it in the Chilean tsunami last year. Everybody goes to the beach sooner or later, and mm-hmm. knowing how to protect yourself when a tsunami strikes, when you think a tsunami is going to strike, is really important. So anybody in the valley, you go to the beach in the summer to get away from the heat. I know you do. Be sure that if there is long shaking, if it shakes so hard you can't stand up, or if it shakes more than 20 seconds, there may not be a local tsunami generated, meaning one that would come very quickly, but there could be. So don't wait to find out. Don't wait for official warning. As soon as you can, get up and walk to high ground and then wait to see if a tsunami is generated or not. Because in Japan, it was 5 to 10 minutes from the time of the shaking when the tsunami arrived. And we don't have certainly as high a possibility of close near-source tsunamis as the Japanese do and as our far northern California colleagues do. But everybody should know what to do in an earthquake, even if they don't live in a high hazard zone, and everybody should know what to do in a tsunami.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. We've been talking with Kate Long. She's the deputy manager of the Quake and Tsunami Program for the California Emergency Management Agency. I'll turn back now to Dr. Stephen Lewis, who joins us in our studio today. One of the things that I think a lot of people don't understand, we hear about Richter scale and magnitude and things like that, quakes in 9.0, 7.0. Can you explain in layman's terms what we're talking about in terms of the way an earthquake is measured in terms of order of magnitude? A 9 is not this one twice as large as an 8, as I understand it.
That's correct. The magnitude scales, and there are many of them that seismologists have developed over the years, is an attempt to measure the energy released from an earthquake. And since there's a huge, huge amount of difference between a really big earthquake and a moderate earthquake and a small earthquake, the scales are logarithmic. And that means that the difference between a magnitude 8 and a magnitude 9 earthquake is 30 times more energy release. But for those of us who live in earthquake country, the issue is not so much the energy release of an earthquake, because if that earthquake is far enough away from where we live or work, the ground shaking we'll experience may not be particularly bad. But even a moderate earthquake with a source very close to us can produce very strong ground shaking. So a magnitude 9, a magnitude 9.5 earthquake like what happened in Japan recently, what happened in 1964 in the Anchorage, Alaska area, 1960 in southern Chile, these huge earthquakes produce huge amounts of energy release. But if we're far enough away from them, they're not likely to be life-threatening, except, of course, for the tsunamis if we're at the beach.
Let's go to the phones now and talk to one of our listeners who has lived through one of these quakes in the Valley. We have Gordon Foster on line 2. Gordon, welcome to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Well, thank you. It's nice to be with you.
As I understand it, you lived through the two earthquakes that struck Kern County in July and later the fall of 1952. Tell us your story.
Well, at that time, I was a young man. I'm aging with my years now. That was in 52. I was about 25 years old and had two small children at home. And the first earthquake, that was in about 5 o'clock in the morning, and it was a terrible shake. It scared me, and I was trying to get out of bed to get my two boys. I had two little boys. They were little shavers, and we finally got up, and after all the shaking and everything, got out of the house, but it did quite a bit of damage. The place that I work was it's a lumberyard, family-owned lumberyard. And we did survive a lot of damage. It was scary.
And I understand there was a second quake, and that caused even more damage, especially in the downtown area.
Right. That came about, I think, about 3 weeks later, 2 weeks later. That was in the afternoon. It hit about 3:30, and it was really bad. I was working in a drafting shop we had above our office in the afternoon, and the earthquake hit, and I couldn't get down the stairs. I just kept knocking me down, and I got out, and again, we did have a lot of damage. Our company did survive, and fortunately, but we did we took quite a bit of losses on the damage to the place. That was it. I don't like earthquakes.
It was a pretty traumatic event for the city of Bakersfield, understand it.
It killed a couple of people were killed, and the damage was quite severe downtown. A lot of the buildings had to be destroyed. They were made of brick, and of course, we sold a lot of building materials, so we came out pretty good on that part.
Well, thank you very much, Gordon, for joining us on the phone today.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate hearing from you and your experiences in living through an earthquake here in the Valley, and specifically that 1952 quake. So many people are new to the Valley or are younger and didn't experience some of these events from the past, even the 1983 event. I think it's interesting to put in perspective for those who maybe moved here more recently that, yes, these things can happen in the Valley. And again, we'd like to hear your story. You can call us right now at 559-275-8989 or toll free 800-224-8989. We'd especially like to hear from folks who may be listening out there and survived the 1952 Kern County quake or Coalinga in 1983. Dr. Lewis still joins us in our studio, and I want to bring it back to Coalinga. As I understand it, again, I'm only a radio host, not an expert on this, but as I understand it, the Coalinga earthquake didn't occur on a normal fault system, or it occurred in a rather unusual way, in some way or sort. Can you help me out here explaining what happened?
Sure. We think of the San Andreas Fault and the parallel faults around the San Andreas as being strike-slip faults, where one plate just slides past the other one with no change of surface area and on along a vertical fault plane. And that kind of motion explains about 90% of the total motion between the Pacific and North American plates. But that other 10%, 5% perhaps, is in perpendicular to the larger trend of the San Andreas Fault. We call it fault normal compression. And the structures that underlie the Coalinga area, the Coalinga anticline, those places where petroleum is produced, is a thrust fault, where one block of rock on the lower side of the fault, an inclined surface, tries to be pushed down underneath the overriding block, sort of like a doorstop. When you shove a doorstop under the door to keep it from moving, you jam the doorstop under the door. It's kind of like that. And it's a fault system separate from the San Andreas but related to it.
Let's go back to the phones now and talk to Herb in Bakersfield. Herb, you're on Valley Public Radio's Quality of Life, and I understand you have an earthquake story.
Well, yes. I've probably got two or three of them. It wasn't related to the immediate problem, but I lived through the Long Beach quake of 1933. I was living across the alley from the Ebell Theater, which became a pile of brick. But 1952, I was living outside of Maricopa at the time. I was operating for PG&E, and I just come off work, and I got up, and I looked out, and I could see a big plume of smoke out on the Maricopa Flats. Turns out it was a transformer that had caught on fire. But since I was operating at the Buttonwillow substation, I was on duty a couple of times for the aftershocks. And probably the most dramatic was an aftershock that hit about 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, pitch black. But we had 110 kilovolt lines and 220 kilovolt lines coming into the station, and when they'd shake, those lines would start swinging together and arcing, and it was such a brilliant display of fireball. I mean, it was, do I stay here, lay on the floor? Do I try to go downstairs, run out in the yard? I mean, it was, what do you do? It was just a absolutely fantastic display of lightning created by these high-voltage lines swinging next to each other. So, yeah, I've lived through a number of quakes, but those were the ones that probably impressed me the most. I guess there was a 1939 Long Beach quake. I was just a little kid, and I was sitting in a chair at a desk next to me. I was sitting on the floor, and I didn't know what happened, but my parents explained it to me, so... They happen. You learn to live through it. California is not falling off into the ocean yet.
Well, we certainly hope that doesn't happen anytime soon. And we really thank you for your call, Herb. Really appreciate your remembrances of earthquakes here in Central California. We're talking with Stephen Lewis, professor of geophysics at Fresno State, about earthquakes here in the Central Valley and what it means for Valley residents. We also still have Kate Long on the phone. She's the deputy manager of the Quake and Tsunami Program for Cal-EMA, the California Emergency Management Agency. Kate, what would you recommend that listeners do to maybe they have never made any sorts of plans? Where can they go to get more information? What would your first line of recommendation be for folks to prepare for an earthquake?
Well, you know, there's a number of things. There's a great site called My Hazards, and that's at myhazards.calema.ca.gov. And you can put in the address of where you live, work, or play, and find out what the hazards are at your address, and that would be fire, flood, earthquake, and also some information on how to mitigate. Also, I really want to recommend the Great California Shakeout, which happens every October and gives us all a chance to practice what we do during an earthquake, because we really need to have sort of physical practice, because otherwise, you know, even if you know what you ought to do, which is drop cover and hold on, not run out of the building, not try to get in a doorway, get low to the ground and protect yourself, and the Shakeout drill can help you do that. Shakeout.org can give you all kinds of information, not only on what to do to protect yourself during an earthquake, but also what you can do to be prepared in terms of planning and a kit at home and how your kids can be prepared at school. A lot of information at Shakeout.org.
Well, thank you very much, Kate. We really appreciate you joining us today on our program here on Valley Public Radio. Again, we'd like to hear from you if you're listening out there in our community. The phone number to call is 559-275-8989 or toll-free 800-224-8989. We'd like to hear your remembrances of earthquakes past here in Central California. Yes, they can happen, and yes, they can cause great damage and in fact, take lives here in Central California. Turning back to Dr. Lewis, one of the things I think you mentioned, alluded to it before, soil conditions also play a big part in the damage associated with various quakes. We saw in the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake, the parts of San Francisco in the Marina District, which were primarily fill areas, had much more damage than areas that were built on bedrock or more solid ground. What does that mean for the Valley in terms of our soil conditions here? And explain a little more about how that works.
Well, the situation is that water saturated soils, water tables very close to the surface, thick layers of loose, unconsolidated, unlithified material, alluvium we call it, tend to amplify the amplitude of the seismic waves and lengthen the frequency. And when the ground shakes at a frequency that is similar to the harmonic frequency of buildings, most buildings we can measure that or estimate it, that's when energy gets transferred into the building and it sways more and more and more until some structural element fails. The situation is that for very strong hard rock like Sierra granites and rocks like that, rocks that really ring when you hit them with a hammer, the seismic waves are transmitted at frequencies and amplitudes that don't harm buildings much at all.
Interesting.
And so depending on where your house or your workplace is located can control or influence the amount of shaking that you will experience in any particular earthquake.
Let's go back to the phones now and talk to Pat in Bakersfield. Pat, you're on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Good morning. Well, I do believe that my house was approximately over the epicenter of the 52 quake.
Really? Tell us
what happened. I lived out in Mettler Station. And our house was ruined. We had a split-level house after the earthquake, and we had to move out and get it repaired. The refrigerator fell over. All the cupboards came off the walls. Every bookshelf was thrown all over, glass. All my mother's canning was on the floor in a mess. And we lived on a large ranch. The reservoirs that had formerly held water were flat, and the former flat landscape had kills, so they could no longer water with underground pipeline. They had to use a aluminum pipeline overhead. Cracks in the ground, and I think I was left with PTSD and had to sleep with a light on until I was a teenager. It was exciting.
It also had to be quite a traumatic event for you personally, but for the entire community.
Absolutely. We moved to town and then experienced the Bakersfield quake as well, so we were quaked out by the end of that summer.
Well, thank you very much, Kate,
okay,
for sharing your story with us today here on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. And again, we'd like to hear from you. If you have a similar story, whether it's from 1952 and the two quakes that hit Kern County at that point, or another more recent event, perhaps the 1983 Coalinga earthquake, we'd like to hear from you. The phone number, again, is 559-275-8989, toll-free 800-224-8989. Before we go to our break, in a moment we'll be talking about the dangers posed to Kern County by the potentially unstable condition of the Lake Isabella Dam. We'll talk about that in a moment. But before we do that, Dr. Lewis, we have been talking about this Bakersfield quake or these two events from 1952. Talk a little about aftershocks, and is the aftershock always much smaller than the first quake, or are there also pre-shocks as well? How does that work?
There can be aftershocks, foreshocks, and then the main earthquake. And, of course, knowing that an earthquake is a foreshock requires waiting until the big one happens in the same region. And then, of course, after the big one happens, like what's going on in Japan right now, there can be many, many earthquakes following the main shock that will typically be smaller. And for the magnitude 9 earthquake that happened in Japan on March 11th, those aftershocks are significant earthquakes in and of themselves.
You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. My name is Joe Moore. Dr. Stephen Lewis joins us today. We'll be back in just a moment and learn more about Lake Isabella Dam and the potential for danger to Kern County residents from that facility and what's being done to help improve it and ensure the safety of South Valley residents. That's coming up in just a moment on Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from Chevron and Abyssinia Wellness Center, online at avecinia.com.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. Lake Isabella Dam was hailed as a marvel of post-war engineering when it was completed in 1953, providing flood protection, irrigation, electricity, and recreation for Kern County. However, recently, concerns have been raised by some. A fault which runs under the upper dam, which geologists thought had not been active in some 3 million years, actually has been proven to be active in the past 3,000 years. And other problems, such as seepage and spillway capacity, have caused the Army Corps of Engineers to undertake an ambitious program to upgrade the facility. Joining us now on the telephone, we have David Serafini, the technical lead for the Lake Isabella Dam's State Modification Project of the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers in Sacramento. David, welcome to Quality of Life.
Good morning. Thanks for having us on.
Walk us through the timeline here. Lake Isabella Dam has been around for almost 60 years. It wasn't until a few years ago, though, that concerns were raised about some of the, in the first case, the geologic issues, the seismic dangers posed by this long-forgotten fault.
Yeah, I can give you a brief recap. So Isabella Dam was designed in the late 1940s. Construction actually started around that time frame. The dam ultimately was completed in the early 1950s and has actually performed very well throughout its life. And up until recently, we realize now that the Kern Canyon Fault that runs through the auxiliary dam is much more active than what we initially thought. Actually, it was previously thought to be inactive based on the tools and the methods we had back at the time of construction of the dam. But, you know, with the recent technologies and new findings and tools available for investigations, we've determined now that no, it's more active than we thought. So that's one of the issues, as you mentioned, as well as the seepage concerns at the project and the potential for overtopping just based on the hydrologic conditions of the watershed.
Let's talk a little bit more about those two concerns. We're actually talking about two separate dams. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the Isabella Project, for those of you that aren't familiar with it, it's comprised of two structures. There's a main dam that sits on the Kern River itself, then the auxiliary dam, which sits over the Hot Springs Valley. Actually, when we look at risk and risk associated with the project, the auxiliary dam actually has more risk than the main dam, just based on issues with seepage and piping potential, as well as seismicity of the site and potential strength loss in the embankment itself. And as I mentioned, with the fault that's active that runs through the auxiliary dam, there's the potential of having some fault rupture or offset of the dam during an earthquake.
Now, I want to turn back to Dr. Lewis here for a moment. We have heard this figure active in 3,000 years. That sounds like a long time in the span of a human life. In geologic time, that's a very short time span. Talk about that.
Yeah, 3,000 years is maybe two blinks of an eye, geologically speaking, even though it feels like a very long time from a human perspective. But I have to put it in context, is that along the San Andreas Fault, much more active than the Kern Canyon Fault, the repeat times for significant earthquakes on any section of the fault appears to be on the order of 200 years or so, 150 years, a little bit variability. So a 3,000-year, at least 3,000-year repeat time for earthquakes on this fault under the dams at Lake Isabella is a long time compared to the San Andreas and other active faults, really active faults.
Let's turn back to Mr. Serafini. You mentioned some of the other issues. It's not just that there's a fault running under the dam. There's other issues with this facility. Let's talk first about the spillway capacity. This has been a very wet year, as we've heard and witnessed this past few weeks here in California. This is an issue with a facility that is also designed as flood control. As I understand it, capacity to handle a major flood potentially overtopping the dam is one of your concerns.
Yeah, we term that as hydrologic overtopping potential, and we do have a very large watershed for Isabella that has both the potential of large snowpack development, which goes all the way up to Mount Whitney, actually an elevation of 14,500-plus feet, and then all the way down to the Isabella elevation of about 2,600. Generally, the hydrologic overtopping issues are driven by rain flood events, so that's generally our November through anywhere from January to February timeframe. So we're outside that window now. We're in the period where we have a lot of snow accumulation up in the watershed, and we're looking at a pretty large storage year, but we're outside the realm now or the chance of having an overtopping issue. It's now more or less, it's going to fill to whatever elevation it's going to fill to this year. We do have a restricted pool elevation based on seismic safety and seepage concerns at the project, and we're going to try to keep it below that.
So what does that mean? It means you aren't filling the dam up all the way, or?
Yeah, the pool restriction itself is imposed to help reduce the probability of failure and also reduce the potential consequences downstream in the event of an issue with the dam. It's basically a short-term interim risk reduction measure that we have in place until we have long-term fixes in place at the project to increase public safety.
The other concern that you mentioned is seepage. As I understand it, all dams have some measure of seepage. This is an earthen dam. What are specifically the issues with seepage in Lake Isabella?
Yeah, so, looking at the dams again, the main dam is actually on a very competent foundation as opposed to the auxiliary dam, which it doesn't have all the redundant features that you would like in a modern-day dam, and there are some issues with some of the foundation materials. It is on a very complex alluvial fan foundation, which poses a lot of challenges, both from trying to understand the composition of that material, but also the potential for flow through the foundation. So there's concerns in some areas of the foundation of what we call seepage and piping potential. of the embankment.
So all three of these together, are they factors that together create a greater threat and a greater risk with this facility? And is that why the Army Corps is embarking on this upgrade project?
Yeah. When we look at it, we know we have three identified deficiencies. We know we have the seepage concerns, the hydrologic concerns, as well as the seismic concerns, which are not just the fault rupture hazard, but the auxiliary dam foundation is potentially liquefiable as well, which means it could lose strength in the event of an earthquake and lead to slope movements of the dam and issues related to that. So our plan is going to address all the failure modes associated with those deficiencies that will bring this project back into tolerable risk guidelines from the Corps' perspective.
What's the timeline we're dealing with here? The New York Times had this article a few days ago about Lake Isabella and other dams across the country that are at risk. It cited Lake Isabella as one of 12 that are ranked nationwide in the highest category. And that's, as I understand it, partly because of the downstream risks. If there were a major event in the worst-case scenario, you have the city of Bakersfield at the other end of this massive wall of water. What are we looking at in terms of timeline, and what are we looking at in terms of risks with this facility?
Well, in terms of timeline, I guess stepping back a little bit, the Corps of Engineers just recently or a few years ago went through the screening assessment of all dams, and that's what ranked Isabella as one of the riskier dams in the nation, which was covered pretty well in the New York Times article. Our time frame now is we have a modification report or a modification plan that's being developed, and it should be finalized this calendar year. In fact, as part of that, we have some public meetings upcoming on the project in the Bakersfield and Lake Isabella areas where we're going to present the first findings of what alternative plans we have on the table directly to the public, and that's actually going to be targeted for the first week of May. That also will go with the EIS that's being prepared, which is the environmental impact statement for the project. Both the environmental impact statement and the decision document for what the recommended set of alternatives will be for the project will be completed this year to take us to a design phase. And we're targeting construction right now for 2014. That's the plan for the project.
When you say construction, I don't mean to ask you to give us an engineer's description, but a layman's description. What are we talking about? A new dam? Are we modifying the existing facilities, or some combination of the two?
It'll more than likely be modifications to the existing facilities. We don't see a new dam being built at the project. We can actually work with the structures we have. Both dams were built very well at the time. They're just were, you know, with changes in time and technology and our understanding of dam engineering, things have been, you know, things have differed a little bit, so we can work with what we have and make the modifications accordingly. And we'll be presenting those actually in May to the public for the first time, the plans that are on the table to fix the project.
Let's go to the phones now and talk to Donnie, I believe, in Taft on line 3. Donnie, you're on Quality of Life.
Hello.
Yes, hello, Donnie.
Yes, how are you doing? I used to go fishing in Lake Isabella.
Yes, and your question today?
Well, I don't have a question. I was just talking about maybe 20, 25 years ago, they used to keep a lot of water up there. I used to go fishing, and it was very nice. But now I've been up there maybe 6 months ago. I live in Taft, California, out of Bakersfield. There's hardly no one out there at all right now.
Well, Donnie, thank you very much for that call. Your line is a little bad this morning. Again, thank you for the call. And Mr. Serafini, is perhaps that reduced water in the dam due to the cutbacks in your agency?
Actually, you know, as of the last few years, with the reservoir restriction being imposed on the project, we really haven't seen that affect the reservoir. We've been just in a dry period up until this season where the reservoir's been low, and it's actually at the elevation it normally would be at this time of year. So we've just been in a drier period. That's one reason that the lake's been down a bit.
Does the effort to keep the lake lower compound the problem of the spillway being undersized?
It helps us to some degree, keeping the reservoir down, but I guess to reiterate, you know, the hydrologic overtopping issues, you know, the those extreme event issues that have a very low likelihood of occurrence are driven by rain flood events, so something that we would see in the December through January, February timeframe.
Okay. One other concern. I was in Bakersfield just the other day and talking with people on this issue. There's quite a bit of concern, not even so much about the risks. Certainly people are aware of the risks. There's concern in Bakersfield from a lot of people about the speed at which this is taking place. I think people are a little impatient. How do you address that? People are saying, I wish the Army Corps was moving faster on this issue.
Yeah, and that's a question we've been faced with along the way. You know, our goal is definitely public safety. I mean, that's our primary concern. So, you know, in the short term, we've implemented a set of interim risk reduction measures at the project to help reduce the risk of failure and increase safety, which include the reservoir restriction as well as heightened monitoring and inspection of the project. But, you know, ultimately here, we're trying to go through a steady process to make the best decision we can for the project and really to minimize any impacts we have around the community of Lake Isabella when we do implement a remediation strategy. So it's a fairly drawn-out process with the Corps in trying to get through what we think is going to be a selected alternative or a preferred plan and making sure that's the right plan for the project and that we're using tax dollars appropriately for it.
Well, thank you very much. Our guest on the phone has been David Serafini. He's the technical lead for Lake Isabella's State Dam Modification Project for the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. You're listening to Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. We'll be back in just a moment and talk about what Kern County is doing to prepare for the unlikely but potentially dangerous event of an issue with the Lake Isabella Dam. That's coming up in just a moment here on FM 89.
Folks, we've got a very entertaining and enlightening program on tap for Valley Writers Read Wednesday at 7. Jim Ashford, an attorney who spent 30 years as counsel to our legislature up in Sacramento, recalls many of his experiences. You know, it was a part of his job to write some of the bills that later actually became law. He witnessed some of the bitter controversies between legislators. He was there when some legislators were investigated for illegal activities. He recalls how some legislators seem to be campaigning all the time. He'll point out some of the good and bad features of term limits and will tell us how a 9-ton statue of Queen Isabella of Spain made it into our Capitol Rotunda. So for an informative and entertaining evening, be sure to tune in to Jim Ashford on Valley Writers Read Wednesday at 7. Join us.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of today's edition of Quality of Life. When you hear the phone numbers, please don't call. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio. We're talking about earthquakes today and the threats that such events could pose to the Valley and Valley residents. We just heard from the Army Corps of Engineers about the work that's being done to help stabilize and make Lake Isabella Dam safer for the residents of Kern County. And joining us now on the telephone, we have some guests from Kern County. We have Georgiana Armstrong, the Emergency Services Manager. Welcome to Quality of Life.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
We talked to the Corps and got some of their technical expertise and what they're doing to prepare the dam to be modified and improved for the future and reduce the risk of a catastrophic event. What is the County of Kern doing to protect citizens in the meantime?
Well, the County of Kern, working very closely with the City of Bakersfield and the Army Corps, has developed an evacuation plan in the unlikely event we did have a dam failure. So we use some Homeland Security grant funds. We have developed a series of activation levels based on criteria established with the Corps. Because remember, the Corps will not say it is time to evacuate a city. What they will do is give us technical information on the status of the dam. And so our challenge was to take that technical information and translate that into first responder actions. And that's what we have done in our evacuation plan.
In the worst case scenario, how much time do residents in Bakersfield have in terms of notification before water from the dam would reach the city?
In the very worst case scenario, if the Army Corps were to call us and say the dam has failed, and that is we have no pre-event warning, which, by the way, they say is the most unlikely scenario. They tell us that a failure of an earthen dam builds up over time, though they cannot tell us how much time that would be. If, however, they were to call us and say, you have no time, the dam has failed, we're talking 5 hours before it reaches the very northeast section of Bakersfield. So obviously the towns of Lake Isabella and Bodfish would have no warning.
What about
that is our worst-case scenario.
What about the notification plan, perhaps in a scenario that's not worst case, heaven forbid that ever happens, but I understand Kern County has a notification plan that contacts residents in some way.
Yes, we do, and thank you for bringing that up. We have a system that we call Ready Kern, which is a telephone emergency notification system, and that's where residents can receive information by phone, by email, by text messaging, to whatever number or email address they choose to designate. Our system is set up and was implemented with landline, white page, phone numbers. But as we all know, most of the time we're at work or we carry cell phones, and a lot of residents don't have landline phones. They only have cell phones. So for our system, at no charge, Kern County residents can go to www.readykern.com and register their work number, their cell phone number, an email address, basically telling us the order that, basically telling us how we can contact them most effectively.
Now, I was talking with some Bakersfield residents the other day. I was in the city and asked people about this issue, and all seemed to be happy to hear that there's great plans in place, but I did see a number of people who were concerned about the speed at which this process that the Army Corps is leading to try to modify the dam and to reduce this potential risk to the city and to property and lives. Is Kern County happy with the pace that this is moving forward?
Well, my understanding, and I am not a dam engineer, I am just an emergency manager. My understanding is that the process for evaluating and determining the scope of the issues with the dam, then designing the kinds of mitigation strategies that the Army Corps is talking about, constructing and implementing them, is a long process. It because whatever they implement has to address all of the deficiencies that they've identified at the dam. The Army Corps is funded project by project, year by year, by Congress, and they have been funded. They have received all the funding that they have requested. So the project is moving forward as fast as can be done, given the scope of the work that has to be accomplished. And we don't want them to rush this. We want this done correctly. We want them to follow their protocols and all of their assessments and review process.
Another thing we were talking about on our program today is earthquakes have been our overall topic. We've looked back into history and going all the way back to 1952 when Bakersfield was struck by two earthquakes that did quite a bit of damage. Obviously, building codes have improved over the years, and so has emergency preparedness. Talk a little about what your organization and what the County of Kern has done over the years to become more prepared in the event. Setting aside the issue of Lake Isabella Dam, just an earthquake in general striking the South Valley.
Earthquake is kind of our bread and butter disaster. It's one everybody practices to and plans to, because it's a threat we all live with, and it's a constant threat and vulnerability for us as Californians. We have updated our emergency plan. We do exercises. We have used Homeland Security grants to buy specialized first responder equipment. We have regular meetings of our emergency council. Our first responders drill, drill, drill. This is what they do. They know how to respond. In my opinion, and I'm just giving you my opinion now, one of the weakest links is individual preparedness. When I go out and I talk to people, everyone has heard, yes, you should have the food and the water and the flashlights and the gloves and fasten down heavy equipment, but so many of us have not taken those steps. And our plan really relies on self-reliance for some period of time for the majority of people, as does everybody's emergency plan. Now, we know that in a major event, we will get resources from the state and other states and the federal government, but this takes time. It takes time to mobilize, and it takes time for those resources to arrive. There is a period of time in a massive event where not everybody's needs can be met simultaneously. So it is so important for individuals and families to have those earthquake supplies, to have that reunification plan, and to know what they need to do in an earthquake.
Again, our guest right now has been Georgiana Armstrong. She's the Emergency Services Manager of Kern County. We also have on the phone right now Chuck Lackey. He's the Director of Engineering, Surveying, and Permits in Kern County. Chuck, welcome to our program.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
We were just talking about the improvements in response patterns to earthquakes. What about the improvements in our built environment? How much better prepared are we now versus 1952 when those quakes did so much damage to Bakersfield?
Our modern buildings are built very designed to allow people to exit out of the buildings without collapse. And so every time we have an earthquake, we learn from what has happened. And we look at our building codes and how we build structures. So we go back and learn from our mistakes of the past. We make things better. We will have damage in a major earthquake. There's no question. But our modern buildings are and infrastructures designed to stay together so that we can recover very quickly.
Is there a lot that professionals in your field, and specifically in Bakersfield, learned from that 1952 quake, or those quakes, I should say, sort of stories from old-timers about, well, you know, this building had damage over here, but this one didn't. Is there still that folklore and that tradition, that institutional memory in Bakersfield from those quakes in 1952?
Yeah, we have a lot of old, we still have some old brick buildings around, and every major earthquake, you see that those are the ones that are most severely damaged. The earthquake that happened over in San Luis Obispo, some of the buildings collapsed that were masonry. They're unreinforced. And after the earthquakes, and just before the earthquake of 52, we started requiring reinforcing in our masonry and our concrete buildings to keep them from falling apart.
It certainly is an issue as California faces throughout with earthquakes. What can people do in terms of if they maybe have an older home or an older building and they want to make sure that they have the best chance of surviving a quake? Are there things that people can do or building owners can retrofit?
Things that can fall down and fall on top of people are some of the most common injuries that come out of earthquakes. Just look around your surrounding. Do you have a large glass object sitting on a shelf that may fall on you while you're laying in bed at night? Things that can fall down off of structures that are not firmly attached to them are the biggest problems that occur during earthquakes.
And before we go, we're just about out of time. I'd like to go back to Georgiana and ask one more time, what can people do to learn more about how to be prepared and the emergency notification plan if they want to sign up for that to be notified in the event of some catastrophic event with the dam?
Well, once again, the website for our Ready Kern system is www.readykern.com. And in terms of preparedness, there is so much information out there at the Red Cross, through through the county websites, through the Salvation Army websites. If people were to go online and just Google disaster preparedness, there is just so much information out there, and so much of it is just common sense. What would you do if everything you currently rely on was not available? As if you were going camping, what would you take with you? What would you need?
Great. Well, Georgiana, thank you very much for joining us today. Emergency Services Manager for Kern County, Georgiana Armstrong. Also, Chuck Lackey, the Director of Engineering and Surveying for Kern County, talking about the response and impact of earthquakes here in Central California. We'd also like to thank Dr. Stephen Lewis, the Associate Professor of Geophysics and Chair of the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences at Fresno State. That's all for today's program. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. And as always, we welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us at talk@kvpr.org. For audio engineer Marv Allen, producer Tracy Sharman, and production manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Quality of Life on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Quality of Life comes from the James Irvine Foundation and Kaiser Permanente.